You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Good to have you listening this morning. As you know, former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin will learn how many years he'll spend in prison today. And next March, the other officers who stood by while Chauvin killed George Floyd will go on trial. This hour, we're examining duty to intervene policies and whether they're effective. The city of Minneapolis had such a policy in effect on the day George Floyd was killed. And although several of the officers verbally questioned what Chauvin was doing, none of them stepped in to stop him. So what does duty to intervene really mean to the practice of policing? Two guests, your questions and observations about this. Do you think policies that require officers to intervene in the behavior of another officer are more difficult to execute than they sound? Have you ever asked yourself what you would do in a dangerous situation when you had to make a decision about intervention? Think about those questions. Think about our conversation developing this morning and join in. Christy Lopez is with us, a professor from Practice Faculty, co-director and innovative policing program at Georgetown Law. Professor Lopez, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me, Carrie.
Bill Finney is with us, former St. Paul police chief and current undersheriff for Ramsey County, and with us from St. Paul. And Chief Finney, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Good morning, Carrie.
Chief, I want to start with you. The city of Minneapolis had a policy in force on duty to intervene since 2016, and it the language said this: officers must, quote, either stop or attempt to stop another sworn employee when force is being inappropriately applied or is no longer required. I'm wondering if that kind of language is pretty common to other duty to intervene policies.
Yes, Carrie. It begins, as Genesis begins with the officer upon entering police service taking the oath of office, where you swear to obey the Constitution, to enforce the laws, to listen to the orders and policies of the organization, and to be a good public servant, public safety officer, and peace officer. It's reinforced with additional policy called, you know, the order to intervene. Often police officers do this on a regular basis, and most often it happens like this. Two officers are at a scene, another officer's there, they get into a fight with the suspect. The suspect gets a blow on the police officer. That police officer may lose their tempers. Mm-hmm. And other officers seeing this intervene by saying, "Hey, Joe, I got him. I'll take him for you." And so they intervene that way to keep the officer who's been aggrieved, so to speak, from being heavy-handed.
So
that happens on a regular basis.
So the officers, when there are multiple officers on the scene, Chief, the officers are also not just supporting one another, but in effect, they are supposed to be a check on the behavior of each other. Is that how it's supposed to work?
Yes. They are sworn to protect the public. They are public safety officers. They are public servants. They are peace officers. They take that oath willingly, and that is their duty, to protect the public, even from officers wearing the same clothes.
Professor Lopez, I read your op-ed in the Washington Post from May of 2020, shortly after George Floyd was killed, in which you acknowledge that intervention is much easier said and done. And for our listener purposes here, I want to read a graph that you wrote in the op-ed. Social science tells us that intervening to prevent wrongdoing in the middle of a tense incident is far more difficult than we recognize. Notwithstanding the legal duty, there are inhibitors to intervention that most officers will be unable to overcome in the moment unless they have been prepared in advance. We'll talk about that preparation a little later. Talk to me about those inhibitors that you think prevent officers from carrying out these duty to intervene requirements.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's a great question because it is, you know, as the chief says, officers do intervene routinely, but it doesn't happen consistently enough because of those inhibitors to intervention. And what we know from the research of scientists like Irvin Staub and others is that there are a number of inhibitors that prevent not just police officers, but all of us from intervening when we should. And we all think we would intervene when we really wouldn't, or that we intervene more than we do. We can all remember a time when we intervened, but we tend to forget all the times we should have intervened and didn't. And with policing, there are a number of specific inhibitors, and the ABLE program I run really addresses those specifically. One of them that's really powerful in policing, and one that we saw very much last May 25th in 2020, is the inhibitor of dealing with supervisors or superiors. Mm-hmm. You know, Chauvin was the one with the senior officer on the scene and the most time on the force, and two of those officers only had 4 days on the force. It's very difficult to intervene in those sorts of situations, and we've seen those situations in other cities as well. The Raymond Robert case in New Orleans is one prominent example, and we have to train officers to intervene even when a supervisor or a superior is the one who is causing the harm.
Professor Lopez, you are suggesting that the chain of command is kind of antithetical or very difficult, let's say that, to the idea that a new officer or an officer who is not, you know, who is in training and not doing the training is going to feel confident and empowered enough to serve as this check that Chief Finney and I were talking about. Yes?
Yeah, and I want to, you know, be clear, there are a number of inhibitors, you know, thinking that other people will do something or thinking that if other people aren't doing something that maybe you're misreading the situation and nothing's wrong with what's going on. And those inhibitors also apply in policing. But one of the ones that we spend a lot of time with ABLE in teaching officers about is this one regarding the chain of command, because it is so, that chain of command is so powerful in policing, and it's a really important inhibitor for officers to be able to, you know, actually practice, you know, how you overcome that in real time, because it's going to present itself, and officers need specific training on that particular inhibitor.
Chief, let me ask you about this chain of command issue, because this is something that the lawyers for some of the other officers are going to be talking about in court when they go to trial. Earl Gray is pointing out, one of the attorneys for one of the officers is pointing out that Derek Chauvin was in field doing field training. A couple of these officers were on their fourth day on the job. And this is something that Mr. Gray is saying. They're required to call him sir, meaning Chauvin. He has 20 years experience. What is my client supposed to do but follow what the training officer said? I mean, you can hear where the defense is going on this. What do you say to that?
I would say that's a very, very valid point. Police officers, when they come out of their police academies, they go on to what we call field training. They're often assigned to a field training officer who is an officer supposed to be experienced in law enforcement patrol practices. And that rookie police officer is there to be judged on a daily basis on how they perform up to standards. This is where it's a very imperative that the administration state and restate over and over again that officers have a duty to intervene when there are situations that just the humanity of a person who's gotten to be the age to be a police officer should understand is inappropriate, even if another police officer is doing that. They have a duty to intervene and say, hey, take a step back. It's very difficult. It's very difficult. We are paramilitary organizations. We're trained to obey ranking officers and to listen to the veterans that have been there for years, and you're just a rookie. And as a rookie, you're supposed to see a lot and say a little. And yeah. Go ahead.
Finish what you were going to say, Chief. Sorry to interrupt.
And so rookie officers are very, very mindful of that. And so tough administration coming down and saying, your job and indeed is in peril, and indeed you may be facing criminal charges if you do not intervene. So that is there to basically tell that officer you have the backing of administration when you intervene on a situation where a member of the public is being violated.
Professor Lopez, I'm struck in listening to what the chief is saying about these requirements and the humanity of this. I'm struck by what you said is also human behavior, that among these inhibitors is what you described as a lot of us think, absolutely, I'd intervene. But research shows that we often don't. I mean, there's a human behavior element to this, too, that we're asking officers to overcome. Would you say something about that before we grab a call?
Yeah, and I think it's a really important point. And it doesn't do anyone any good, and it's not accurate to demonize officers who don't intervene and say they're obviously evil people, because I think none of us really knows for sure what we would do in that situation. And what we know from the research is that many of us don't behave as morally courageous as we would like to think that we would. But what we do know, and if there's one thing I hope that your listeners, whether they're police officers or community activists trying to change policing, take away from this program, what we do know is that you can actually train officers in the skills so that they're more likely to intervene, and that when they do intervene, it's effective. And that is, you know, the two-prong approach, the training, the skill training, and then agencies have to create the culture that supports active bystandership. And if we do that, we can make it much easier and create an actual practice of intervention to prevent this harm from ever happening in the first place.
Yeah, I'm glad you use that term, active bystandership. I know that's something that Washington, D.C. is training on, and we'll come back to that in just a moment. If you've just joined the conversation, former St. Paul Police Chief Bill Finney with us, current undersheriff at Ramsey County, and Christy Lopez, a professor in the Innovative Policing Program at Georgetown Law, to talk this morning about duty to intervene policies. There was one in effect on the books in Minneapolis when George Floyd was killed. We're examining why it is that the other officers who were on the scene did not intervene enough to stop what Derek Chauvin was doing, why that is a high bar in the culture of policing and in human behavior. I mean, we're really trying to understand what we're asking other police officers to do. And I'm asking you this morning whether you think the policies that require officers to intervene are more difficult to execute than they sound, now that you've heard what the chief and Professor Lopez have to say. And then you hear us talking about human behavior. Have you ever asked yourself what you would do in a dangerous situation when you had to make a moral decision about intervention? Maybe you've had some experience with this. Maybe this is something that you've thought quite a bit about. You stood by, or, you know, at danger to yourself, you did intervene. It's something that I think a lot of us wrestle with. And to Alex in St. Cloud. Hi, Alex. What do you want to contribute here this morning?
Hi. I'd just like to say that duty to intervene policies are toothless while we have qualified immunity in the law.
And why do you believe that, Alex?
Because qualified immunity is a legal protection for police that prevents them from being sued as individuals for their actions carried out as police officers. Derek Chauvin, as an individual, cannot be sued for the murder of George Floyd. Only the Minneapolis Police Department can be.
Chief, we hear this a lot, that these qualified immunity laws are contributing to the police violence that we see. I'd love to hear your view on that.
Well, you know, this is kind of a double-edged sword. I hear the public anguish and often misunderstanding why we have qualified immunity. But think about this. We ask mortal police officers, human beings, to put on a badge and to go into harm's way on our behalf. And often in going into harm's way, they have to make split-second decisions, which often ends in life or death situations.
Right.
They are still mortal. And if they're thinking that I am not supported for going into harm's way on behalf of the public And my family's at risk because I could be sued and lose everything I have, my family has, et cetera. They may hesitate when we need them not to hesitate. When we take a look at all the mass types of shootings and things that are going on in today's world, we expect police officers to boldly go into that situation and to eliminate that, to get the safety back, to eliminate the version meaning harm to others. If they have to think about other things other than doing their duty and rushing forward, we'll have a terrible situation.
Professor Lopez,
remember,
go ahead.
Those law enforcement, those jurisdictions still are liable for the actions of their police officer. So if there are civil suits to be paid out, that's where it's paid from.
Professor Lopez, this has been a lively discussion in our community for some time. What do you think about these qualified immunity laws?
Well, a couple of things. One is, I don't think it's really fair to say that you need qualified immunity to protect officers, because they're dealing with, these split-second decisions. We already account for that in the Fourth Amendment. The use of force is only unreasonable if it's unreasonable in light of all those difficult situations officers face. And you only get the qualified immunity if a use of force is found to be unreasonable already. So the Fourth Amendment already provides the kind of protection that the chief is talking about. And it's not easy. I wrote another op-ed for the Washington Post that talks about how we've made it artificially difficult to actually hold jurisdictions liable for the actions of their officers, which means they often don't provide the training they should that would prevent the kind of harm, like this kind of training on how to intervene. So I think that's, qualified immunity is absolutely not an obstacle to accountability. But I think the more important thing here is that, this duty to intervene policy has been around for almost 50 years. A 1972 case called Bird v. Brisky was the first case that said that officers have a duty to intervene. And now every federal circuit in the country requires officers to intervene. And there are actually a lot of cases that say this is clearly established law, so qualified immunity isn't going to be the obstacle in some of these civil suits the way it is with some other kinds of police misconduct. But nobody wants to get to that point. Nobody wants to get to the point where an officer has caused harm and has to be sued civilly or criminally charged. What we want is to prevent these incidents from happening. And it's really important to understand that just as we've had case law requiring duty to intervene for 50 years, but officers are still not intervening when they should, a policy also is not enough. You really need to have that training and that culture that will ensure that officers actually intervene as they are required.
Chief, do you concur with that? It really is all about the training?
Well, training is very, very important. Training and retraining and reestablishing and reemphasizing training is an ongoing process that needs to occur in every organization. But I may have some disagreement with the professor on whether or not qualified immunity is necessary or not. Mm-hmm. Yes, if a person is outside the law, I expect that they be arrested and placed in the criminal investigation and prosecution. And that doesn't matter if you're a police officer or not. But what I'm saying is the majority of police officers follow and obey and do the law as best they can. And what they don't need to be ever mindful of is if their actions is going to cause their families to be ruined.
Okay. Call from Margaret in St. Paul. Hi, Margaret. Thanks so much for calling. It sounds like you've got some experience with intervening. Is that right?
I do. It was probably about five years ago. I was in Washington, D.C. with my teenage son and my husband.
Mm-hmm.
It was a beautiful October morning, NEA weekend, walking down the mall toward the Capitol for a scheduled tour, and on a gorgeous day, noticed this man punch his wife in the nose, and I could actually hear a snap.
Oh my gosh.
And I saw her buckle over and pull her hijab over her face and kind of go into the back seat of the car and bend over, and I walked to the man. And I said, I didn't know what language he spoke. I just kept saying, no, 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 you do not do that to a person. And then I looked at the children and I said, this is not acceptable behavior. I hope you don't ever have to see this again, but I want you to know this is not acceptable behavior. And then I stood there, and my husband and the child were staying away from me and weren't walking toward this, but I could not stop myself. Meanwhile, another man, who was much more subtle than myself, sort of went to the corner, and I believe he called or dialed 911 to report it, because he also saw this. And the man was just so angry. It was so disturbing. I felt like he had to have broken her nose. We stayed there for a while. My husband and child kind of just stood there, too, and said, absolutely not. And sadly, these children looked so blasé. That was it never left me. I felt like, oh, my God, they must see this all the time.
They were traumatized.
They were totally traumatized. Yeah, it was very sad.
Desensitized.
And sadly, we had to go to our tour, so we stayed for a couple moments, and I prayed that somebody did show up. And anyway,
wow,
I never forgot about it.
I mean, I have to tell you, I kind of got a sick feeling in my stomach listening to that. I think Professor Lopez is going to tell us that kind of intervention is fairly unusual. Is that right, Professor?
Well, we don't really have a good sense of how usual or unusual it is. I do think it's an important form of intervention, and I'll say it's, you know, what we say in our ABLE training is the earlier the better, and better late than never. And I think one key point to take from that intervention, she was not in a position to intervene in time to prevent that punch from happening. But even intervening afterwards, and I really love that she told the children, this is not okay. Maybe they did look blasé at the moment, but that's something that they might go back to over the years to understand. And it's really important for adults to do that with children, to, you know, help set those really positive norms, and for other officers to do, right? This is not okay. What you just did is not okay. That can set norms for the next time. And it's really part of creating that culture of bystandership and of people knowing, like, look, I'm not going to stand by while you do things like this. Mm-hmm. And that can influence behavior.
Chief, I'm curious about what the expectation is when it comes to law enforcement intervention, because both of the rookies that were on the scene the day George Floyd was killed, Thomas Lane and Alexander Kung, used physical force to help restrain George Floyd long after it was necessary. This is what the investigation finds. One of the officers held his back. The other officer held his legs while Mr. Floyd was already in obvious distress. So if they had been obeying the duty to intervene policy, what would they have been required to do if Derek Chauvin was issuing orders and making it clear this is what was going to happen?
Well, you know, I think what they should have done, in fact, one of the officers that I understand that mentioned that that Mr. Floyd was under some stress and maybe we should turn him over or something to that effect. He's a rookie. He should have said, listen, let's just get him into a different situation. Let's set him up and then kind of reinforce that. That probably would have got him fired by the senior officer disagreeing with that at some point, saying this guy should have done what I told him to do rather than what he did. But wouldn't be facing criminal charges and Mr. Floyd would be alive. Those are the things that have to be reinforced in training over and over by the administration, saying this is what we expect to be done before we get some citizen who's abused or loses their life as a result of police actions.
Call here from Bill in International Falls. Hi, Bill. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. What do you want to tell us?
Well, I'm a psychologist over 70 now. Mm-hmm. And over the years, running around with long hair and beard, I've been stopped or at the borders, different places, local policemen pulling me off the street for no reason. Mm-hmm. And
you're saying you look like a ne'er-do-well, Bill? Is that what the
time,
problem
not
is?
Anymore, no hair left, but, you know, in the good old days.
Okay.
So I noticed that when a state highway patrol, any interactions I've ever had with state highway patrolmen have been very professional, very polite, very respectful. The local, I think a lot of police officers or men that go into that profession, I don't know about the women so much, are kind of going with a macho chip on their shoulder, and they automatically assume the worst, and they act very macho. I'm talking about the local police officers. And I've always wondered if maybe the training at the state police level wasn't more longer carried out, more years,
okay,
and better in some way, because I don't notice that at all. The different states I've been in, when a state highway patrol officer has had interactions with me, it's been completely different, okay, than the macho approach that the local people have.
I think I have the nugget there of what you wanted to talk about. So we'll get a look at the latest news. And when we come back, I want to talk about what Professor Lopez has referred to as active bystandership methods. How do you train for it? Is there a difference in the way different departments and law enforcement officers train for this? And more of your calls and your questions. If you're getting a busy signal, you can try us back a little later. You can also reach me on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. Back to our conversation now. Professor Lopez, I'd like to ask you about this active bystandership. I was reading about the Washington, D.C. Police Department's training in this. So how do you balance these methods for active bystandership with this respect for the chain of command that a department has to have to be effective? How's it work?
Yeah, so you know, the chief noted that, you know, what the officer should have done, and I think the really important thing for people to understand is that what we know is that officers aren't going to do what they should do unless they get training, and that's not because they're bad people, but because it's really hard. In my experience investigating police departments all across the country for about 25 years, is that a lot of departments say they're providing this sort of training, but they're just not. And so that's why we started, it's actually Georgetown Law School, we started the APRE project, which stands for Active Bystandership for Law Enforcement. And we're providing that training free of charge to through a train-the-trainer program through agencies across the country, including but not limited to Washington, D.C.'s police department, the Metropolitan Police Department. We have departments as large as the NYPD to tiny departments of just a few people. And you can get on our website, and we really want this training to be available to everyone. And what's important about the training is it builds on the work of social scientists like Irvin Staub, and it's a very professional and very pedagogically strong curriculum. And we really focus on teaching officers the science so they understand those inhibitors and how they're going to need to overcome them, and then a lot of scenario-based role play and how you actually do that. And I'll give you just one example.
Good.
We adapted an approach that the airline industry uses because it was seen that co-pilots were not intervening even when the pilot was about to fly the plane into the side of a mountain, right?
Oh, wow.
So to get to your point about the inhibitors and how you do that in the chain of command, that in the cockpit of an airplane, that chain of command is very strong to the point where a co-pilot would allow the plane to be flown to the side of the mountain. They came up with an approach that we adapted. We call it PACT, and you can apply it to the Chauvin murder of George Floyd. It's probe, ask, challenge, take action.
Hmm.
So we saw one of the officers that day probe. He twice asked, hey, should we roll him over? Hey, are
right.
we okay?
Right.
If he had received ABLE training, he would have known that he was likely to be rebuffed at that point. And then what you do is you ask, hey, I'm concerned. And then you challenge. You need to take your knee off his neck. And then you take action. You actually physically move that superior officer off the individual. And when officers are trained that this is something to be expected, and when they've actually physically gone through those motions of having to do that, it's just more likely that they'll be able to do that in the moment, even when they're dealing with a senior officer, because they know to expect it and they know the consequences of what might happen if they don't take action.
You know, Chief, this is what I wondered when I asked you about what the other officers should have done. If it gets to the point of physical intervention, and I hear Professor Lopez saying that is a later step, but it is a step mm-hmm. that you may need to take. Chief, I wonder how many officers would really do that.
Is a difficult thing to do, and it depends solely on the culture of the department and their level of training and commitment mm-hmm. to doing that. Some departments are more amenable to that type of a training than other departments. And it's almost a case by case. But should it be instituted? Absolutely. Should those officers or the officers that raised questions been able to feel that he was comfortable enough and forcing the issue of the knee on the neck? Yes, absolutely. In fact, many of the officers that I know in the profession, there's no one I know that defends the actions of former Officer Chauvin. But it's difficult for rookies unless they are trained constantly. I think the program that the professor was talking about sounds like a real opportunity to prepare officers for the future.
Yeah, I'm not. So, Professor Lopez, do you know whether Minneapolis or St. Paul's police departments have taken advantage of the ABLE training?
St. Paul has not. Minneapolis has not, but I believe is scheduled to begin with the training us. So we're looking forward to that.
Good.
St. Paul Park is part of the training. And I just want to reemphasize something the chief said that was so important. He's absolutely right. It is all about culture, which is why our ABLE training, you know, and part of culture, part of building culture is training, right? That's why we're really emphasizing this. But that's why part of the project is not just training. We really emphasize, you know, having a strong anti-retaliation policy, following this up, having commitment from the chief on down, all those sorts of things so that officers know, like, this is how I'm expected to act. I will be supported when I do this. And if I don't, I'm going to be held accountable.
Right.
All that's a really important part of creating that culture, because the chief is right. The training is really important, and it will influence some officers' behavior regardless. But to really make this part of your agency, it has to be supported by agency culture.
Call from Sue in Minneapolis. Sue, thanks so much for waiting. I really wanted to get to you, and I'm glad you had a minute to wait. Tell me a little bit about how this works, and you're in the medical profession, it sounds like.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I am a physician and been practicing for 25 years. About halfway through my practice, safety, the issues became more forefront in terms of wrong side surgeries, et cetera. And the medical field, at least in our system, adopted an approach very similar to what your speaker was saying, based on the airline industry experience. And the training now that we have on all levels is that in any medical team situation, anyone in the room who is technically taking care of the patient, not just the physician, but the nursing staff, et cetera, can ask for a moment of clarification. And our common language is just that, I'd like a moment of clarification. And then everyone in the room has to stop and look at that person and have them say what they need to say, and then resolve that question before we move on. So each level of our staff, whether you're a nurse, physician, et cetera, is trained in that, to respect that common language. And it gives us an actual comforting, what words do you say to make everyone stop and you rectify, you know, do we have the right patient? Are we making surgery on the right spot, et cetera? Very comforting.
Yeah, I hear this, that it's not accusatory. It doesn't sound judgmental. But are you saying that, you know, let's say a newish nurse who might be assisting, you know, at a lower level in a surgery can intervene if she's concerned that the surgeon is about to make an error?
Correct.
Really?
Anyone in the room. In fact, I start every procedure by saying, I'd like to open this procedure to everyone in the room. Please make a point of clarification if you see anything that I'm doing that you would like me to address.
Wow. I'm so glad you called. I wasn't aware. So is this common, do you think, to most hospitals, medical institutions, or is this something new that your organization is doing?
Well, we've been doing this for many, many years. I'm not sure how they do it in other medical systems, but that's what we are trained at all levels in our system.
Okay. Professor Lopez, what do you take from that example?
Yeah. Yeah, so we actually train up, we use the airline industry as an example. We also use operating rooms as an example because of the hierarchical, you know, similarities that the doctor just described. And I really love how she described this. It really emphasizes a couple of key points. One is that common language, so that you're noting now is time, you know, to pay attention to this, the asking for the moment of clarification. The way that happens often with in the policing context, we have, you know, officers having gone through the training will have an able pin, and we'll often see officers can just like kind of tap it or point to it, like, hey, you know, we need to stop here and reassess, or you need to back off, or you need to think about what you're doing. And what I really love about what the doctor said is how she starts every procedure with saying, like, hey, you know, we're like, you know, there is no, you don't get to say, like, I can't call the doctor on this. I want those moments of clarification if you see the need for that. And we train officers through ABLE that part of a successful active bystandership program is not only training officers how to intervene upon other officers, mm-hmm. but training officers how to accept an intervention and how mm-hmm. to make it clear. So we will actually, that's why we start our training with the chief and the higher up officials. And so then they tell people, I expect and want you to intervene upon me. I don't care if I'm your superior, if I'm doing something that's dangerous or harmful. And it's a really important part of the culture and of the training. So I really appreciate how the doctor is emphasizing that. And I also want to point out that one of the reasons we emphasize the airline industry and the medical field, and also we talk about college campuses and friends don't let friends drive drunk, is to emphasize for officers that this is not picking on police officers as somehow deficient and you need this training and you need this program. Everybody needs this training and this program, and we're just trying to apply it in a manner that's specifically tailored for policing.
Chief, very interesting to hear how they do this in the medical industry and in the airline industry. I'm also very aware that often in these situations where there are guns present or some other kind of weapon and things are moving fast and there's a lot of fear, you know, driving and adrenaline driving this, it is not the same. I'm curious about what you hear in the examples from Sue and that Professor Lopez are giving us.
Well, I think it starts to set a professional expectation that subordinates can intervene, regardless of the profession, when something is being done that threatens the safety of a member of the public. I think that message can be carried across to many other professions. I'm often, encouraged by the duty to intervene. Even though it's not a duty, it's a desire to intervene, like our people that are passengers on airlines.
Right.
When they see someone threatening the safety of that whole plane, and those people just intervening and making sure that threat is neutralized until professionals can arrive. I'm encouraged by that. I would love to see some of that action in our communities with individuals who are just being a danger to the communities, willy-nilly firing rounds into communities, et cetera, with citizens that would react.
Good question here from Sarah in Brainerd, who called Chief, who says there's been some discussion about the importance of the culture and if the new officers had confronted the senior officer in Floyd's situation, but junior officers face threat of termination. I think Professor Lopez addressed this idea of retaliation. Sometimes that is really hard to suss out, right? It's so subtle and endemic within the culture. No one will admit to it. So what do you do about retaliation, Chief?
You know, in that situation that we're talking about, as I said earlier, those individual rookie officers who would have intervened would more than likely been terminated because they were on probation.
Uh-huh.
But they wouldn't have been criminally charged, you know, in the situation they are now. And maybe they could have even made the case to have a second look at that senior officer and his actions. As I understand it, now that he's convicted, he had a similar situation in 2017. So there's a pattern and practice that's going to be sorted out with the federal government stuff on that individual. But those were the choices I think those young rookie officers might have been facing. And it's a choice that all officers come in when rookies hit the street. They work with veterans, and often the veterans will say things to them similar to this. Hey, kid, forget about that stuff in the academy and let me show you how it's really done on the street.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you have to have a culture that says, hey, hey, knock that off. We're not playing that game. We're going to do what's been taught in the academy. You're going to adapt that training to the street situations, but you're not going to be contrary to that. And that's an individual cultural difference department to department. Some departments are very good at that. Some of them not so.
You know, Professor Lopez, I that makes so much sense, and it's so clear the way the chief presents it. I just can't imagine somebody who's only been on the job a couple of weeks hearing a training officer say, you know, hey, I'll show you how it really works, and you know, refusing that or arguing with that in the moment. I mean, this is sensitive. What do you say about it?
So it is difficult. There's no denying it. But I think, you know, we should remember that it was an officer with 4 days on the job who's the only officer on the scene who twice tried to ask Chauvin to stop. And you can only wonder what would have happened if that officer had been actually trained how to do that. And supported by a culture that gave the officer more confidence. So I think that tells us that even in that really difficult circumstance, that officer's trying to do the right thing, and we should give our officers credit. You know, if we give them the support, so many officers will be able to do this, notwithstanding how difficult it is. And I think, you know, the chief is talking about culture, and again, he's 100% right. There are some things we can do, concrete things that we can do to support that police departments should be doing, that communities should be demanding. As part of the ABLE project, as I said, it's free to join, but we do have the 10 program standards, and they're designed to help create that culture. And I'll just give a couple of examples. One is we require that an agency have a strong anti-retaliation policy for all the reasons the chief just talked about. We also require that you have a policy where if you are investigating, let's say you're investigating a use of force, a complaint about an excessive use of force, and you see during that investigation that there were a couple of officers who were standing around and didn't do anything, you also have to investigate those officers and see whether they could have. They can't always. They aren't always in a position to have been able to intervene. But you have to determine whether they were in that position and should have intervened. Because then you have what we call sort of a carrots and sticks approach, right? You want the chief to be supporting people and lauding people who intervene. And you want officers to know that if I don't intervene, I'm going to get in trouble. Not just, you know, the horrible event that no officer wants to see where someone might die, but just the more everyday, like I might get days off. I might get suspended for a few days because I should have intervened and didn't. So the sorts of incentives are how you actually encourage the kind of culture that you want. It's very concrete in many ways, and agencies are not doing the things that they could be doing to support a culture that would facilitate active bystandership.
Chief, what do you think?
Gary?
Yeah, go ahead.
Gary, it comes down to who you select to hire to be a police officer. I think the emphasis on, and I always try to, as best as possible, look for people who wanted to be public servants first rather than law enforcers. You see, I could take a person who's public service-minded and teach them how to enforce the law, but if I have a person who is law enforcement-minded, I have a difficult time teaching them to be a public servant because they see themselves as a hammer to enforce the law, and everybody else is a nail. And so those individuals are more difficult to deal with. And so you look for people who want to be public servants first. And then we train them to the culture of our department, to how we deliver that service, how we live up to our oath of office to protect and serve and to be good public safety, public servants.
So a question here then, Chief, from Pamela in St. Paul. Pamela, what are you curious about?
Well, I think this is a great show, and I really think this point about training officers carefully and in these new techniques is great. But I think that in the case of Minneapolis, it was such a failure to have Chauvin as a trainer. Like he already had all these cases against him. It was very clear that he was an aggressive, assertive officer. And how could he have been put into a position of training? And it makes me think that the Minneapolis police force had a huge problem if he could be a trainer.
So
because he's going to teach people you know, he was clearly a super aggressive person, and how he's not going to teach people to be a careful police officer, in my opinion.
So, Chief, I just want to make sure. I don't know if he had a number of cases against him, but he had complaints against him. What about that point of why was he selected to be training for all of the complex reasons we've been talking about this morning?
That is the difficult question that I'm afraid Minneapolis police are going to have to answer, because if you have a pattern and practice of behavior like that from a particular officer and they're put into a higher degree of authority, you have to explain that now that he's convicted of criminal offenses.
Professor Lopez, I'm curious. I'd love to have your answer on that, but I'm also interested in how you ascertain with your ABLE program here, these active bystander programs, that you've got field training officers who are also reinforcing that. I mean, how do you make sure you've got the highest quality field training officers who embody everything that we've talked about today?
Yeah, and I think those are really, all of this has been a really important part of the conversation. And I want to make clear that nobody is saying that ABLE training is going to fix all the problems of policing.
Got it.
We haven't even talked about the really big element that was present in the George Floyd case and is present throughout policing, which is, of course, race.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that we believe ABLE can have an impact on, but there's so much more work to do. And the same with these issues. I mean, the caller is completely right. How is it that Chauvin was allowed to stay on the force and remain unaccountable for so long? The chief is right that recruitment and training is really, recruitment and hiring is really, really critical. But I think what I have learned in my 25 years of doing this work is that there are a few key things that can help facilitate a culture in which all of those other things that we're talking about are more likely to fall the right way, right? A culture in which people are more likely to call people like Chauvin on their bad behavior and get rid of them before too late. A culture that supports the recruitment and hiring of the right kind of of individuals who are public servants and not bullies, right? And what's really taken me about ABLE and why I've chosen to spend so much of my time on it is that this is an intervention that not only can prevent that immediate harm, but really be used to help create this kind of culture in which all of those other things go well, because you're training officers to speak up, regardless of what the rank says, to do the right thing, to step in. And that has ramifications that can go far beyond that individual moment of a potential use of excessive force and really shape agency culture in a positive way.
This has just been super enlightening. I really appreciate it. Professor Lopez is co-director of the Innovative Policing Program at Georgetown Law, and Bill Finney is former St. Paul Police Chief and current undersheriff for Ramsey County.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!